How many people want to hear more about the business perspective behind Web 2.0 and revenue generation? Okay, good. How many people want to hear about the programming aspects of Web 2.0 as it relates to building web content? Okay, all right. And then, okay, that's pretty much all of the questions I had. So,
yeah. I'd like to hear what you think Web 2.0
is. Okay, good. So this presentation is one, I actually gave this at the TwinCities.net user group on Thursday. So if you were there, you may want to leave. And can everybody see the slides? So I'll kind of jump around, but what I'll talk about in high level is overview of Web 2.0 with perspective. So I'm going to skip over the O'Reilly slide and jump right into kind of what we, and by we I mean Dow Jones, think of Web 2.0. I'm going to do a deep dive into a product that we have in the marketplace, which is, to my knowledge, the very first Web 2 product in the financial services space, and then talk a little bit about what we're doing with future plans. You guys know this, Web 2.0 is a grab bag of different technical capabilities. This is the classic O'Reilly slide of kind of Web 1, Web 2. I will highlight, as we all know, that there's a fair amount of debate, particularly amongst the technical community, about what Web 2 is. I would take a moment to comment here that, you know, a lot of people look at it and say, well, Web 2 is a marketing term, it doesn't mean anything, it's the Java of 2005, and it isn't going to cure world hunger and cancer. You know, really, to me, I don't really care. I kind of cordon that to the debate about, is VI better than Emacs, and should we be using Unix or Windows? At the end of the day, it's irrelevant, and we're really talking about the application. And it's clear that we can build really robust and sophisticated applications in this environment. So our perspective as in our corporation is that we believe that Web 2 is a game changer. I think that that's evidenced by what Google has done with both Gmail and Gmaps. And we do believe that it fundamentally changes how people interact with the web. You know, I would highlight for all of us here, I bet that the very first time you went to Gmaps and you clicked on that map and you flung it, and it moved, that permanently altered the way that you thought that that mapping sites should work. The very first time that somebody went to Gmail and you delete that email out of your mailbox and the screen doesn't disappear and come back and then it's like, oh, the email's gone, it just disappears. That changes your expectation. And I think that that will happen in every vertical online. This slide is one that this is kind of my perspective on what I see the Web 2 stack being in our space. By our space, I mean in the internet. So I really divide Web 2 solutions into three categories: presentation, integration, and foundation. So by presentation is the most simplistic use of Web 2 technologies. Really there, it's kind of the Gmail example. Yeah, it's a completely new user experience. It changes my expectations. But it's not a fundamentally different approach to email. Right, it's something that Microsoft Outlook and other mail clients have been doing for years. So there's not a game changer there. It's just I refer to it as kind of bigger, better, faster way of doing things. The two other areas that I have, your integration and foundation, are where I think the real opportunity is. Presentation is really an isolated opportunity. It's something that all of us in our ventures, whether we're doing something in open source or whether we're doing something for profit, it's something that we can incorporate and makes our applications better. It's a better approach to user experience. But integration and foundation are different business models or different technical solutions to existing problems. So integration, for example, the best case here, I think, is sforce.com from Salesforce. Salesforce has come into a market that was traditionally dominated by enterprise software providers and has now become the de facto standard for CRM and SFA applications in the enterprise. I'm stunned at how many companies I go to, and they're not even doing RFPs anymore. Why would I bother? Everybody uses Salesforce. I'm just going to go to Salesforce. And the great thing about that is that the integration model is completely blown up. Used to be that if I wanted to get data from my SFA application into my ERP application, I had to go through all these, you know, DTLs and get it all over here, and then people had to work for 6 months and do all this programming, and it was a big pain. But with S-Force, I can jump all those technology stacks and just go from one point to the other point, and I don't have to go through the intermediaries. And that is a game changer, both in terms of how quickly you can produce things and how agile you can be in your development. The foundation layer is, to me, the most exciting layer. And this is something that I believe that every industry will establish a key set of foundation players that are providing these ground services. The best example here that is most widely adopted is Google Maps. Gmaps is, you know, a wonderful service on maps.google.com, but that isn't really the game-changing aspect of Google Maps. Google Maps is a game-changer because of all the mashups and all of the, frankly, businesses that have been built off of that, whether it's real estate listings in San Francisco or Chicago crime rates or weather underground visualizations or my own hobby site, Road Sign Math. So, you know, you can extend that through the whole internet. So what I see in the foundation place is companies providing a Web 2 API JavaScript solution that solves the needs of an entire vertical on the internet, or did I use that wrong? So, or an entire horizontal, whatever, pick your favorite. So in here, you know, I would be so bold as to say that if your company selling geographic information services, GIS software, to major corporations, I think that at the end of the day, Google Maps takes away your business, because they solve not only the foundational aspect but also the integration aspect. Why am I paying $300,000 for GIS maintenance every year when I could simply get a license key of Google Maps and put a mashup and I could have it right in my ERP system? So it makes total sense. This is where we, Dow Jones, are focusing, and this is where, you know, when I think about opportunities out there, this is where I see the biggest opportunities, and they're the opportunities to become de facto standards across an entire vertical. So, and feel free to interject with questions. I'm going kind of fast because we don't have a ton of time. So key things that we take away from Web 2.0, there are a lot of things. If you read the O'Reilly paper, which if you haven't and you're here at this discussion, you really need to read it. The key tenets that we take away, the biggest and most important one is co-developing with customers. And that's important in the context of the space that we're playing. If you're working in the foundational space, the co-development issue is the most important one. And that fundamentally what you're doing is enabling mashups, which we have a technical audience today. I would really encourage you, when you talk to people and you mention mashups, please just tell them it's a product. Because a lot of people want to think of mashup and they don't know what it means. It's just a new product. That's really all that we're talking about here. The other things I've kind of already touched on. So let me talk a little bit about live quotes. So that's kind of our perspective. We think that Web 2 is a game changer. Our perspective is that the biggest opportunity to be had is in this foundational aspect of providing a foundational base. And our goal in what we're doing at Dow Jones is to create a suite of financial APIs that will satisfy the needs of the entire industry and become the de facto standard for how financial websites work. Now, I know that not everybody is in the financial space. I would argue that you can look at pretty much anything, right? Sports data. Why can't sports data be made available via a suite of APIs? Why can't weather data be made via APIs? Traffic data. Essentially, every vertical of the information stack can be made available via this way. And if you have rights management, what?
A lot of it is, right?
Yeah. And if you can get in there and create the API, you have a tremendous amount of power. Now, one of the things that's really important in this space that we've realized, and I think you'll see this when we talk about the demos, is that not all these services are made equal. Gmaps has gotten wide and huge adoption. Now, Microsoft has responded. They have API that you can build mapping solutions off of, and so has Yahoo. But there's a great analogy. You know, we all know the name Sega in the video game space, right? Where's Sega now? I don't know. Who cares? Right? They're irrelevant. It's Sony and Microsoft. But many would argue that in the year 2001, 2002, or excuse me, 1990, early, mid-90s, Sega had the best hardware in the market, by far. It was the fastest processors, the best GPUs, the most memory, but the development environment was really hard. If you talk to the developers, they would say it's really hard to develop games on the Sega hardware. And the same thing holds true in the modern era. It's KISS, right? Google Maps is super simple to implement. I've tried to implement Microsoft Maps and Yahoo Maps. The APIs are just harder. and you're creating barriers to entry. So really designing an elegant API is a key differentiator. And that's one of the things that we did in this project, in this product that I'm about to demo for you. So what this product does and what we built, and by the way, the gentleman over here at Ludigarden actually wrote the code that makes all this work. So if you have questions, he can answer the more detailed and specific programming questions. But the requirements were that we wanted to stream data to a browser, but we wanted to work that with no plugins, no Java VM. So it had to be a complete thin client JavaScript environment. Timers, not allowed. The idea of polling, even if you're going to poll like every 1 second and get data, for our industry, that's not acceptable. It has to be event-driven. When something happens on the server, you need it in the client as soon as possible. That required a really different approach. Needed to work at internet scale. So we have MarketWatch.com has about 10 million unique users every month. We're the largest independent financial website on the planet. And we knew that we needed to be able to handle tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of users simultaneously using this product. Resiliency, so that you know bad things happen on the internet, you have to handle it and you have to work through it. And the last item is really important, easiest thing you've ever implemented. We wanted our customers and the people that worked with us to say to come back to us with that feedback. We also wanted to learn from others. We completely looked at GMAPs and said, how do you integrate GMAPs on a website? We want to know that. We looked at a little library called JS Math, which is a library that I use, and I was like, wow, I really like how this integrates. It allows you to put tech, T-E-X, tech on a page, and it renders it in math. And I was like, wow, that's a really great integration method. So the solution that we built for this is essentially we created a publishing server, which is called LivePost Broker. It's an ASP.NET web application in C Sharp. The secret sauce, if you will, is that it's a completely server-side asynchronous solution. So we're handling our threading model independent of our traffic generation, and we're able to create a solution that is extremely efficient with processor, and as a result is able to deal with over 1,000 requests per second per node, linearly scalable, etc. And then we created a subscribing client, which is the LivePost JavaScript library, which is browser resident and thin client. It's object-oriented class library. And it provides this thin client integration. So we provide both a simple style, which you'll see in the demo that I'm going to do, as well as a way to create function endpoints and then register them for callback with the library, which is how you can create much more extensible solutions off of it. So let me show you how that works. Now, as a headline, we all know that the stock market's not open on Saturday. So, and this would be a really boring demo otherwise. So, what I have running on my laptop, I actually have an isolated LivePost server on my laptop. I have the client running natively on my laptop. And I'm feeding that LivePost server on my laptop an artificial feed. We essentially captured 6 hours of trading activity one day. So, I'm just feeding that into it. So, you're going to see trading activity. Obviously, it's simulated because the markets are not open. So, with that said, the first thing I want to show you guys is I'm going to show you just how easy this is to implement, which I think really epitomizes one of the key goals of this project. So, this is a web page. For imagination's sake, imagine that it's on my website, thingleside.com. And I happen to like these three stocks, and I wanted to share with some of my friends the movements of these stocks and my portfolio. So I've got Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo, and a couple of shares of each one. And just to show, you can see this is calling localhost, and this is the actual page. It's just a basic HTML page, nothing fancy, handwritten. And I'm going to go ahead. So the very first thing I need to do is I need to put the price for these securities on here. Now, there's a couple ways you could do that. If you're a big enterprise environment, you could probably have some back-end service that gives you that data. If you're a little website, there may be a web service that you could call, but it's not native in HTML, so how do you do that? So we can instead use live quotes. So the very first thing we do is we take this script tag, which effectively loads live quotes into the page. And we just put that into our head. And you see this really big, kind of nasty, gnarled number. That's just an armored text that includes like your access rights. We are the only people that can create those. It uses a sophisticated cryptography so that we have controlled access to who can use the library. The next thing we have to do, this is effectively including this script block, and excuse the analogy, but it's kind of like loading the DLL into your process space. Yeah, it's there, but now you need to do something with it. And we have to kickstart the Live Quotes library into actually functioning. So we put another script block on the bottom that just simply says, Live Quotes setup. Just tell it go, essentially. So that's great. I've got on there and I've started, but I haven't actually requested any data. So I'm going to take this table data here. I'm going to copy this and replace that here. Now, let's take a moment to just look at this. It's just regular HTML, but you can see that I've added these spans here. And it's very readable. Span class equals MW Live Quotes. That means Live Quotes is going to grab it. Symbol US colon Goog, so that's Google stock. Field price format plus two, which just means show two decimal points. Don't need to be an expert to do this. Pretty much anybody with basic HTML skills can do this. So I'm going to save this, and I'm going to go back to my web page and hit refresh, and there you go. I got the prices, and magically they're updating, and that's all happening event driven. I could put as many of these as on the page as I want. I could do kind of infinite flexibility with that, but I've got everything that I need there. So that's neat. Let's extend that a little bit. And the first thing I want to do is, it's really typical in the financial world that when things change up, they turn green, and when things change down, they turn red. So I want to show that because when these values are changing, I'd like that to be a little bit more obvious. So this is one of the things that's important about building solutions in the Web2 space, is I think you have to go with the grain of the web. So there's a number of ways that you could do that. We could include it in the JavaScript. We could kind of take 18 different approaches to that. But we chose to simply just create another style. So I'm going to take this style, I'm going to put that style into the page. And you can see I'm just creating a new style, and I'm giving it to the MW Live Quote spans. So totally with the grain of CSS, and the browser, in effect, is now going to do all the work for us because we have an up, down, and on change extension, and I can go ahead and save that, and I'm going to hit refresh, and now I get color flashes, and I get the correct coloring of the actual prices. Very simple to do, and I can just change the CSS to change that behavior. Now, the last thing I want to do requires some extensibility because I have this gain-loss field, and I want to actually show that, but that's not straightforward because I need to multiply. I need to do some math, right? I have to take 10 shares times the change and actually put that there. Now, I could do that in a JavaScript function, but how do I make sure that whenever it updates, I automatically get that? So here is where we actually jump into the callback stuff. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a new function on the web page called showChange. And I'm just going to put this anywhere is fine. I'll put it up here. And so I'm just creating a new global function page scope called showChange. It takes a symbol object and then does a little bit of simple math. Keep on hitting more things. And then, now that's great, I've declared the function, but now I need to tell Live Quotes that that's its callback function. So I'm going to go in here and I'm going to replace my setup library with something just slightly more complicated. And all I'm doing is declaring another global function called bindBox, which takes a ticker, an element ID, and for the sake of the demo, I'm hard coding the shares. And then so I call setup, and now I'm calling bindBox, which registers with the JavaScript library that for this ticker, I want to have an event fired off. And here's the div that it's going to go in, and here's my number of shares. So I do that, hit save, go back, and hit refresh. And now, voila, I've got my gain loss, and it's dynamically updating. So really, really simple to show. And if you're curious about the business aspect, when I show this to people in the financial services world, like Fidelity and Schwab and E-Trade, they go bananas. They absolutely, it's like literally, they're like, wow, that is so easy. So it's really cool. So this is one example. It's pretty simple. I want to show a couple of other more sophisticated examples that I'm not going to dive into all the code for.
Can I ask a dumb question?
No, there. Go ahead.
Why do they go bananas?
Because it's that easy. They didn't have to...
To implement?
Yep.
In their interface?
They don't have to put anything on... So there are two reasons. It's that easy, and it's more sophisticated than anything they have. So they didn't have to build a back-end server. They didn't have to install any software. They have to do nothing. And they get streaming for free. which to them, it's like there's no other way to get streaming. They, you know, they could put a Java client in the browser, then you got to build it. That's hard. You got to deal with the scale issues. We're going to solve all that for them. So hugely impressive to them.
So they don't have access to some of the tools already.
They have access to the data, but they have no way to scale it out on an internet level. And in fact, many of them do have streaming solutions, but the streaming solutions are typically going to be like a Java client, or they're going to be something that is limited to maybe a few hundred simultaneous users. You know, for example, a company like Fidelity can only host about 50 users per streaming server, to give you an example of how, it's really interesting. So,
and that is actually I've used their application, used it for a couple of years, and the streaming was always very flaky.
Yeah.
You could never be sure that you have great data.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, those really sophisticated, more kind of fat client approaches, they've actually A/B put ours on a page and theirs on the page, same page, and we're getting data significantly faster than they are. So,
how do you handle it on the server side where you're not basically chewing up every socket you have for a gazillion machines?
Give me 2 minutes to get there, okay? I want to show you the rest of the demos, and then I'll jump back into the solution. So here's these demos are kind of, they're more for eye candy, but they're kind of fun. So the first one is a demo called Thermometer. And what we're doing here is simply taking a thermometer, green to red, and we're positioning the stocks where they are and then moving them based on the price movement. This is the same live quotes library. It did no change in the back end. It's all just changes if I view the source. You can see I'm creating some additional libraries or some additional functions, but it's really trivial to do. So that's one. I have this other demo called Popcorn. It's kind of a fun one. And what we're doing here is fairly obvious. Whenever the stock ticks, it bounces a variable height based on the amount of change. And notice the asynchronous behavior. Even when something's bouncing, its color continues to be modified, and the price changes as well. All that's handled by the browser just by managing the divs. Another one called Gray Grace. Essentially, is every time the stock ticks, it moves forward, and when they get Google's coming from behind, and
they
when
they today's gonna be dirty.
Yeah, exactly. So, and when they get to the finish, they win, and
he's got it set up.
What?
What the finish?
Just that it's had a certain number of ticks.
Oh.
So eBay won, and of course we're all winners at the end. So, and the last one is a extension of, how many people played with the canvas function in Firefox? It's really cool. You can create two-dimensional drawing surfaces and you get kind of standard draw line, draw rec kind of capability. So this is actually creating a tick-based chart. Each one of these is just a Firefox canvas, and I'm doing my own graphics manipulation here. Only Firefox and Safari support canvas. But hopefully we all use Firefox. So. A complete bigot. So. All right, so there you go. So those are the demos. So I'm going to kill my quote player. Let's talk about the solution a little bit.
I can also throw in something more about the why people go crazy about it is to the kind of stack sense presentation is the integration, because on the one hand they could have like a group of 10 engineers coming to quarters making a B2B system that has their servers they have to have operations maintained, or they could have like those could be put together by one of their tech guys over a weekend in spare time and then not have any of their own server side liability or data center maintenance anything.
We actually had the wonderful situation where the pitch that I keep on giving to our business people is I want to say sell to the tech group, make them rock stars, and everything else comes for free. And we had a customer who we gave one of their developers a key for live quotes, and he had been working on a couple of projects with the business and it wasn't really going anywhere. And he spent one day, created 4 applications off of live quotes, showed it to the business, they went ape. And he's a rock star, right? I mean, he's leaving the office with the best day at the office that he's had in years. And the business is then coming to us saying, he's saying, get the commercial arrangement done and we can launch. You know, what a great position to be in from a sales side. So, So this is a little bit about the logical system diagram. So getting to the question about how do you deal this without tying up a bunch of sockets. There are three fundamental aspects of the LiveQuote system. There's the data pump, which in essence is a very isolated system that takes that data stream and turns it from one format into the format that the broker wants and just pumps that data in. And that's this is all, by the way, built on Windows Server 2003. So that's a Windows service that we can control and just say, you launch, and then it starts filling up with data. The broker is the ASP.NET executable that runs in W3WP, and it has significant. There's this concept of a symbol. So when you fire up, and let me actually talk about the browser side too here. Then we have the browser, and in the browser we have two concepts. You can have the basic HTML page, or kind of your own Web 2 application. But in either case, you have the LiveQuote library loaded into your process space, and it's running. So the basic paradigm that LiveQuote uses, I'm going to jump ahead to two slides, is that when you launch. So on the left here is the LiveQuote.js, and on the right is LiveQuote's broker. You launch, you take that key, and the JavaScript library, the very first thing it does is it says, give that key to the server. And the server comes back and says, either no, that's not a valid key, go away, or that is a valid key, and here's your license response. And we do a couple of things in this. The library, you don't actually give the real library on that response because you want to be able to version that independently. So what we do is we give a couple of constants. We generate a one-time proof key that is then used as the interchange between the browser and the server. And that proof key gives us essentially the library a chance to say, yes, you're a valid LiveQuote server, and I'm not being hoaxed by somebody. It then tells you, here's where the real library is. Go get it. And that's just a static JS text file that lives on the server. Absolutely, exactly like Google Maps, by the way. Then it gets that back and it says, okay, great, thank you for my proof. It then says, I'm going to subscribe. So what it's done at that point is it says, there are five things on this page that I care about. So it says, subscribe me up for those five things. And here's my proof to prove that we're the same people, that we're talking to each other. The server then takes that and says, okay, great, I'm going to take those five things for you, and I'm going to give you back a ticket called ticket number 12, and that's the ticket that you're going to use for our discussion going forward. So he gets that back and says, okay, ticket number 12, good. Now that's the handshaking process. So now the LiveQuote library, the very first thing it does, and remember it's kind of its own app running in the browser, right? It's got its own life cycle, its own management, it's doing its own things, independent of what's happening in the browser otherwise. So the LiveQuote library then says, great, go get ticket 12. The very first time it has no data, so the server comes in and says, ticket 12, here you go, there are your five things, done. So that's the pickup response, and then it gets it, and then it immediately then says, okay, great, I got the data for ticket 12, now go get new data for ticket 12. So that comes in, and you'll notice the vertical axis here represents time. So it comes back again, says, give me ticket 12, and there's this gap because nothing happened. The data hasn't changed. You have the most recent data. So what happens at that point is that you've gone into the thread pool. The thread pool said, nope, you don't have any data for you. Go back, and asynchronously kind of puts you into the parking lot. And interesting enough to answer your question, that effectively takes no resources. A little bit of memory, no thread, no CPU, to just have that socket sitting there doing nothing. Then when the server sees, okay, great, I got data for ticket 12, picks your connection back up, gives you the data, you return, and then immediately you process that and then come back. So this handle, now there's one variant of that, which is that if for some reason nothing happens for 20 seconds, we return back to you with a no operator. And the reason why we do that is that we don't want firewalls to get really kind of suspicious and say, like, why has this HTTP connection been open for 2 minutes? I bet it's tunneling an SSH connection, and kill me. So we don't let you last for more than 20 seconds. We return, and then you come back. So that's the communications pattern. This is how it maps out physically. And this is actual. We have two data centers, one in New York, one in New Jersey, completely physically separate from each other. and they're fed independently. There are four servers in each one, and the client is running on any number of client machines. By the way, you can, the JavaScript library is one model. We also wrote a BlackBerry library, so I can integrate Live Quotes data on my BlackBerry as well. So the model is pretty easy. There's one thing that we do here, which is that we do not stick you to a web server, so like you could come in and hit any server, but we did build into the protocol the concept of forwarding. So if you come to a server, say you come to server 4, that ticket that you got back encoded in there is this ticket came from server 2. And server 4 gets that and says, oh, this ticket's from server 2. I'm not going to have the context for that. So then it operates as an HTTP proxy and just goes to server 2 and says, I'm representing this user for this ticket. And then the same process happens back. So if server 2 it will just return an error to the client, and the client then says, okay, my server went away, and then reestablishes its ticket. And that all happens transparently. The user never knows that actually took place.
So it's just like a reinitialization process.
Essentially, yeah. So this is the communications pattern with an exception. So here the same thing happens, but when you get a response back, you got something like server too busy, which is not JSON-encoded data, and the client has no idea what to do with that. And in that case, it's just wrapped around a big try-catch, and it will wait for 4 seconds and then try again. The wonderful thing about this, if you've played around with other streaming libraries, we can actually take a client, have it running on a computer, disconnect the network cable, go to bed, come back in the morning, reconnect it, and it will start ticking again. It doesn't require human intervention in any way, because it will just try forever. Little bit of statistics about the solution. It runs on 8 servers, commodity hardware, Dell PowerEdge 1850s, 2 gig of RAM, dual 3 gigahertz Xeon processors. Disk is totally relevant. We have this fully deployed on MarketWatch.com, and it uses about 60 megabit of bandwidth just for MarketWatch.com. We're currently doing an eval with a very large media company that I can't disclose, and on their website it uses 180 megabit of bandwidth. So one of the things that you can take out of this is that one of the things that we're planning for is that if you are looking at that foundation piece, your scalability modeling has to be extreme. I mean, I can clearly see a model where if we have 6, 7, 8 customers using this, and then if we open it up to the public via non-commercial private use license, that we could have hundreds, 200, 300, 400 servers using, you know, 2-3 gigabit of bandwidth just to serve one application. So, and I love that. That's great. So a barrier to entry. So, lessons learned. This is a little bit technical. I'm going to skip over some of these things, but asynchronous programming is hard. Lou can attest to that. ASP.NET 1.1, not so good, dealing with really high CPU utilization. There's a concept in here that's important, that when you build, and I think this is true for anybody who's doing AJAX development or something where you have programmatic web connectivity happening, is that at the end of the day, what Live Quotes ends up operating to us like is a self-imposed distributed denial of service attack. Because every single person that's interacting with our service is constantly barraging us with activity. So we had to figure out a way to handle that. So we implemented this thing into the protocol called BackOff. And what happens is that the servers all monitor their own utilization, and they let it run free up to 100%. And these servers literally run all day at 100% CPU utilization. And then when they start to fall behind, they start to increase this back off. So when you get that response back from the library, you'll notice that one of the items back in here is back off. That's simply a number of milliseconds that the library on the client will sleep before coming back. So by default, that's something like 200 milliseconds. But if we have a huge increase in traffic, that'll just automatically start increasing. And what's so wonderful about that is that it turns the issue of scalability into a business decision and not a technical fire drill. It's no longer like, oh no, the servers are dying, go to Best Buy, quick, you know. It's just simply like self-adaptive. And then you just sit down and you go, okay, well, a lot of usage. If we want it to be faster, we've got to make a capital investment.
Well, in time of a market meltdown, the client still can't cheat. They'd have to hold their gun.
Yeah, they could. But it'd have to be hard. It'd be hard.
Yeah, if you're talking 200 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds, it's probably not worth the time to do that.
Exactly. One of the other takeaways, browser compatibility, those of you that are working in this space, not as big of an issue as we thought it would be. I mean, we're serving, like I said, 10 million unique users using this library. Not once have we gotten a comment from a user saying, I went to your website and got this JavaScript error. Now, that doesn't mean it's free. You have to deal with it. But you can abstract it away in your object classes pretty well. The cross-domain security issue is a really big one. This is an application that everybody always wants to say like is an Ajax application. It actually doesn't use Ajax at all, because Ajax is limited to only talking to the domain you came from. And we made this in a way that it can work in any domain in the world talking to our servers. So it doesn't use a XML HTTP request in any way. It does use JSON for data formatting. JSON's a great way. If you're looking at transmitting data back to browsers, use JSON, don't use XML. Way, way faster. I can't do the demos part two because I'm offline. And just our future, you know, what we're doing is obvious. We're taking this library and we're going to take this approach to every part of the financial vertical and provide a suite of applications that we can extend across everywhere. So, and this is kind of the model of where this is heading is we actually are working in an environment where we're bringing SOAP envelopes and SOAP messages to the world of Ajax. So we've developed a library where you can send native two-way SOAP messages from services that are resident on your enterprise service bus to clients that are running distributed throughout the world. And it's a full, not just receive, but send. And then when you send, actually get a message back because you are individually addressable, which is a little bit of magic that we figured out. So that's it for the formal sides. I pitched Minibar as well. So. I'm curious. Questions, comments?
Is your development organization all here?
For this stuff, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as a whole...
Is this the old MarketWatch?
It is. It's the old MarketWatch and previous to that, the old BigCharts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lou and I are both BigCharts.com pedigree. So.
How big a organization is
it? We're right over there on the third floor. Uh-huh. And we have, in Minneapolis, we have about 100 people in the office. And the technology organization in Minneapolis is about 70 people. Mm-hmm. So about 50 of those are engineers. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk for a second?
And we are hiring. So Rick, we are hiring.
Yeah. Could you talk for a second about some of the Web 2.0 applications that are out there where this issue of we're going to open up our API, and we want you to use it, but we don't want you to be too successful.
Yeah.
Where do you see it getting to the point where it becomes an issue of, okay, now we're going to maybe have to start metering it over a threshold?
Yeah, I mean, I think the model there is, I honestly don't want to sound like we're just ripping them off, but I look to Google Maps as a good example, as a good bellwether,
right,
to say, make it public. But there is a per-day use limiter that if you're on a really big site, the key will invalidate itself after a certain number of uses. The other issue is it's got to be non-commercial. So the way I look at it and the way I look at it from as a CTO of Dow Jones, right, why would I want to do this, is that I see it as using the open source model to spur innovation. Because what I want to do is, you know, I've got bouncing boxes when something ticks, which is neat, and it's visually kind of appealing.
Right.
But I'd love to see what, you know, Bob in Kentucky, who happens to have a really cool way of looking at data, can do. And why not bring that capability back, right? So if you use the public license in the right way, I can say, yes, you have a non-commercial use for this, and go crazy. And if you do something really, really creative, we can spin that back and bring that to the marketplace, or allow you to monetize that in the marketplace. So couple of different approaches. Okay. But that's the business reason for why I would want to do that, is to get innovative product. My favorite quote about Web 2 stuff is a quote with the product manager of Google Maps, and it's an interview in the New York Times. And the person said, why did you make Google Maps so open and API-driven like this? And it wasn't we're going to make the world a better place, and it's just all great, and everybody's beautiful. It was, even us, Google, with a ton of money for R&D and a ton of really brilliant engineers, we knew we would not be able to create every solution that the marketplace needed.
Right.
So just open it up. And I think that is an exact analogy for so many businesses. I know it's true for us. We don't have all the ideas. And why not just blow that up? Because the first person to blow that up will have some ability to leverage it.
Right.
The third person to blow that up will have no ability to leverage it. Right.
Yeah. I think of namespaces. As you do more mashups, you start writing the namespaces. For example, I'm a technology journalist. I have a blog on livejournal.com. They've got a service called Live Quotes that says things people are saying about Microsoft. And I want to mash that up with your Live Quotes.
Yeah.
How?
Yeah. It's a problem. I mean, right now, unfortunately, there's no coordinated way they're dealing with that, other than the things that
are
crazy.
Some of the WSDL people are talking about patient scoping, but you're not using that. Everything's a global function.
And what we're doing is, like, ours is called MW Live Quotes. That's its global signature. So, and everything is under that base class. So.
Yeah. And again, some of this is inspired by GNF, but if you look at them, what they have is everything is within a function.
Mm-hmm.
So it's none of it's landing globally, but that function itself got a little anchor point added to the window in a couple of different ways, a couple of different variables.
Right.
So like you saw earlier, it said MW Live Quotes dot setup and like MW Live Quotes dot get application.
Yeah.
So we kind of expose that one thing symbolically, and everything else is gotten through it.
Yeah.
So. If you collided, it would only be at the window MW Black Quotes. Everything else is a child of that,
mm-hmm.
And not global.
Right there.
Yeah, so here's what we added, and we have the setup exposed, and we have get application exposed, and you'll notice the rest of them are off of the app.
And the rest of the library is actually, that's one of the issues that you have to deal with, is that you do want to obfuscate this stuff so that it's not like copyable by everybody in the world. And so when you load the library, where's that going to be? It should be right here, right? All files. Yeah. So this is what the actual library itself looks like.
Is that how you hide that key then?
No, the key is crypto protected.
Okay.
But this is the actual code. But you'll notice like function uz takes a k. But you don't obfuscate the ones that are exposed to the client. So somewhere in here, if I do a find, I'm going to find live quotes. Well, maybe not. I don't know. Somewhere. But
it's obfuscated so well.
Yeah.
It comes right at the bottom of yourself. The last one you hit was.
Oh, the last one was? So. We have like time for one more question, and then we need to keep on the schedule. But anything else?
I got to leave, but did you already talk about how long this took to develop?
That's it. So this is not a good use case to model after. Essentially, Lou and I worked together to create a prototype that we showed the business, which had no back end. And was simply just the live quotes library hitting some kind of mock backend. That took, 2-3 weeks to make?
Yeah, it's completely synthetic, done wrong, not a line of code ever intended to be real, so it wasn't scalable, it was polling.
Yeah, so we just wanted to show the interaction. Showed it to the people on the business side, they went ape, and it was essentially like, can we launch this as soon as we can possibly have it? And it was built and launched in 22 business days in full production. Now that's, I don't want you to take away from that, well, anybody could build it in a month. Because it was one of those things where, you know how it is when you're on a project and you know it's a winner, you know it's really important, and I honestly couldn't sleep. I was waking up, towards the end, I was waking up every day at 4 or 3:30 in the morning. I could not sleep. I was just like, oh, we got to do this, and then that. And so that was pretty awesome. But
yeah.
I don't think Lou would want to do it again in 22 days.
Well, there was also somebody in the field who was trying to create a thing that was similar. It was polling, and they were having it came out.
They're sucked.
But
they wanted to steal our thunder.
Yeah. So we were kind of like,
we were going
pissed off at the same time. Really.
We were going along, and then smartmoney.com released something that did it visually looks similar, but it like pulled every 7 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I came to Lou and I was like, we have 2 weeks. If we can get it out in 2 weeks, we can still claim at least shared first mover advantage. But after that, nobody will care. And they ended up turning theirs off because it didn't work.
Yeah. One last final comment. The server side IHTTP async handler with the begin execute and end execute. The begin execute you return because you have a callback. So once you return, you're threadless. This thing will run 1,000 or 1,200 or 2,000 outstanding requests, and it does it with a thread count of a couple to 20 thread count on the server, which is how you can get that sort of like slow response, because you can wait up to 25 seconds before it's firing data back out for 2,000 people at once and not kill the server.
Why that actually works, why your async stuff scales so well, is because it changed how that works in the back end to use IO completion ports now instead of running
ASP.NET 2.0, you even get to async more easily with the ASP.NET. That's something that's very different. But the async handling is always there, and it's always been IO completion ports.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. We have to stay on agenda. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.